Good to be here at the One Turner Church in the middle of winter. Always a pleasure. Could have been up on the Gold Coast, but no, here in One Turner. And I love the fact that this church is so indicative of a cold weather church. Everybody sits at the back. For some reason, there's something about the One Turner Church where all of you sit way at the back. And I don't know if it's because of the little sign that says, if you sit in these chairs, you're now going to be on television. And maybe somebody has not taken care of the back of their head as they were taking the comb through it this morning. It certainly is good to be here. And thank you very much, Tim and team, for the music, and Natasha as well. And it's always a blessing to be in church on a Sabbath day. I say welcome to those of you who are watching online. I know that Kimberly and Kirsten in the Puget Sound in Oak Harbor are watching. Hello, my love. Nice to see you. Well, nice for you to see me. and, of course, on the right, I have our son Alec and his good friend Keanu, who are from Avondale University. They've been working in the town of Bright, taking care of laundry for the last few weeks. I think they're sick and tired of laundry because the house is full of laundry that has been undone. So it's good to have them with us as well. Just a couple of stories that I want to share with you before we actually get into our sermon today. And if you don't like the sermon, you're going to have to blame Natasha, because she's the one who chose it. We decided that was the direction that we were going in today. So I want to share with you a little bit about what's happened in Papua New Guinea. For those of you who are not familiar, we had the PNG for Christ program in the month of April, and I did not want to go. I was forced to go because of my position, not because of my interest, because I'm not an evangelist. There's some individuals who are very good at actually being able to speak in front of people and bring them to Jesus. That's never been my gift. My gift has always been about sermons and speaking in small groups and enjoying. So it was quite a challenge to think about going to Papua New Guinea and to get all of the shots that you need to get to survive living in Papua New Guinea, and the fact that you have to have a protocol officer with you at all times just in case somebody chooses to actually kill you. Fascinating, to work in that environment. It's an amazing country, and the motto of the country is, expect the unexpected. That's definitely concerning when you come into the country. But an amazing country with so much joy and happiness, and we had a marvelous time there. There are about 100 Australians who went over and were a part of the 2,300 sites where evangelism was done. They told me that they didn't know that I was coming until 3 weeks before I came, so that I had no idea where I was going. They did not know who was coming. And in that three-week period of time, they actually put together a poster so that when I got off the plane in the city of Leh and walked towards the front entrance, there was a whole group of pathfinders and all members of the church who came to greet the international speaker, Pastor Terry Johnson. I found that to be hilarious and great fun, and we certainly enjoyed it from that moment on. They told me, we're going to have about 1,000 people, so don't worry too much about it. Everything's going to be okay. First night, we had 7,900 people, and by the end of the last night, we had 13,800 people who were attending in the rain because there was no building. We were out in an oval. There was no concern about how wet they got. The dirt was not dirt. It was mud. They still came in their droves because they wanted to hear the gospel. Isn't that wonderful? Wonderful stuff. So many stories that I could tell you, but I'll tell you two. The first has to do with the fact that I have a baby in Leh that's named after me, and no, it's not mine. we went there, and there was this pregnant woman who asked me to have prayer for her. Now, this is an interesting story because in the country of Papua New Guinea, if somebody calls you a witch, anybody is allowed to actually kill you. And this woman was called a witch. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church has a program helped by ADRA Australia, which is really kind of cool, where they have built a safe place right next to the Pilgrim Seventh-day Adventist Church. You can't see it because it's in the bush, and they have to have it in the bush because all of the women and children who are in that safe haven have to be protected 24 hours a day in case their ex-husbands or their communities come to kill them because they're considered to be sorceresses. And so the Seventh-day Adventist Church members are the ones who actually come and feed them. It's the teenagers who actually watch guard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the teenagers of this church, who make sure that the people are safe inside this community. And they also teach them how to cook, how to become seamstresses so that they can make an income now that they don't have any connection with their villages. Quite a challenging environment. And there was a woman there who was about ready to give birth who asked me to pray for her, and I prayed for her. And then when the baby was born a few weeks ago, it was a bouncing baby boy. named Terry Johnson. I told my wife, she was not impressed, but pretty funny. I just found out about that on Wednesday when I had a conversation with a couple of our folk from Papua New Guinea. Second story, and this is an amazing story for me personally. The first night I got up and I was getting ready to preach, and they said, Pastor Johnson, you look very nervous. And I said, well, you guys told me 1,000 people. That's bad enough, but there's 7,800 people out there and it's raining. Oh, don't worry about it, Pastor. There's going to be more coming. Well, that's why I'm nervous. Oh, you can't be nervous, Pastor Johnson. The Bible says that we cannot be double-minded. You're a president of the union. What are you doing being double-minded? I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's chastised. And I said, when I get out there, who's going to be interpreting for me? You know, because everybody else is speaking pidgin. I don't speak pidgin. Pastor, don't worry about that. That's God's problem, not your problem. You get out there and you just preach and the Lord will take care of all that. I must have looked a little bit lacking in faith because they looked at me again and said, Pastor, you're being double-minded again. We can see it on your face. Get rid of that double-mindedness. Now get out there and preach. Do your job. So it doesn't matter how bad you preach, Pastor, because it's not about you, it's about the gospel. And so I got out there and I stood in front of those 7,800 people and started preaching. And at the end of the program that first night, I had several people come up to me and start speaking to me in their native tongue, believing that I spoke pidgin fluently. And I had to call an interpreter and say, please, can you interpret what these people are saying? It was incredible. And it happened like that across the 2,300 sites where so many people were hearing the gospel in their native language, not just pidgin, but in the native languages that they spoke beyond pidgin. Incredible to have that and to see Acts chapter 2 happening in front of us. 300,000 people were baptized in the course of a couple of weeks. The church membership in Papua New Guinea went from 750,000 members, 450,000 members to 750,000 members. And by the end of this year, they're looking at being around 800,000 to 850,000 members in the space of a couple of weeks. Just in case you want to be involved in something like this, over the next 4 years, starting in 2026, after next year's big session year with General Conference and everything, in 2026, we're going to have Trans-Pacific for Jesus Christ. In 27, it's going to be New Zealand for Jesus Christ. In 28, it's going to be Australia for Christ. So start thinking about that as the One Turner Church. What are you going to be doing to sow seed and getting ready to have a harvest in 2028? And then in 2029, it's going to be PNG for Christ again. And we're just looking to see what the Lord is going to do. It's incredible. You know, we were in South America just recently visiting some of our unions and our institutions there. We've got Adventist universities there with 19,000 students. 7 years ago, the University of Peru, Adventist University of Peru, started its first medical program, and everybody in the country said, this is not going to go very, very far. You know, it's the first graduating class won't do well. The first graduating class was last year. They ranked third in the medical exam in the entire nation. First year of graduating from our university there in Lima. And then we have the university in Sao Paulo, which has 21,000 across three campuses. Amazing work, and yet their percentage of Adventists to non-Adventists is about the same as what we have here in Australia. One Adventist for every about 390. For us, it's one Adventist for every 409. In Papua New Guinea, it's now one Adventist for every 12. One Adventist for every 12 people in Papua New Guinea. The question that they're asking is, if there is one Adventist for every 12 people, why hasn't our country transformed? That's a good question, isn't it? Because as Christians, we should be a leavening effect. There should be transformation in the community, and that's not happening. And that's one of the things that they're looking at in terms of discipleship. All right, come with me to the book of Genesis and to a very interesting chapter, chapter 38. The reason that this chapter is so interesting is because in chapter 37, we see the story of our favorite good guy, Joseph. And in chapter 39, we continue our favorite story of Joseph. And everything about Joseph is that he's a man of integrity. He never does anything wrong. And in chapter 37, we see the story a little bit of Judah getting involved with Joseph and how Judah is the one who actually suggests that he needs to sell Joseph into slavery so that they don't kill him and really kill their father in doing so. Judah's name means God be praised. Everybody repeat after me. Judah's name means God be praised. Every time that we see the name Judah in Scripture from now on, please, instead of saying Judah, say God be praised. Here we go. Verse 1 of chapter 38. At that time, God be praised, left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Abdullam named Hira. So at the time that he had sold his brother into slavery, there, God be praised, met the daughter of a Canaanite man whose name was Shua. Not the daughter, but the man. The girl's name we never get because she's a pagan woman, and for some reason, Scripture neglects to actually give her name to us. And so we miss out on who she actually is, but we know that her father's name was Shua. He married her, he slept with her, she became pregnant, and she gave birth to a son who was named Ur. What a great name, huh? Ur. Many of you have had children who have been born in error, but none of you have named him Ur, have you? Right. Who was named for Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son. She named him Onan. Now, this name is fascinating. We're going to get to that here in a moment. And she gave birth to still a third son and named him Shelah. What a great Australian name, eh? Shelah. It was a Kazib that she gave birth to that third boy. And here we start the story. So we've got a few things that are of interest. First of all, we've got a man named, God be praised. He's the fourth son of Leah. Not of Rachel, but of Leah. Leah is not the favorite wife of his father, and so he's grown up in the shadow of Joseph and Benjamin. And Judah is actually the name given to him by his mother when she had a conversion experience. When Leah went from being a pagan woman to a believing in God woman, she starts naming her children better than the first one. Her first son is named Reuben. See a son. I've got a boy. The girl doesn't have a boy, right? So I'm now should be favored. And it keeps on going like that until you get to Judah, where Judah's name is God be praised. But God be praised is not a good man. He doesn't do a lot of good things. In fact, when the opportunity strikes, he actually chooses to marry people who are not really part of his religion. And he marries this woman from Canaan, who he has three sons with. He names the sons, and each one of the names of the sons is quite interesting as well. So the first son's name is Ur. And Ur in Hebrew is the reverse of Re, R-E, which is as close as you can get to the word for evil as you can possibly get. And it's interesting that this particular name is one that the rabbis have spoken and written about because of their concern about what Ur was doing when he first got married. And we're going to get to that here in just a minute. The second son's name is Onan, and the second son's name means the virile one. And it's exactly what it means, even in our Western context. This is not virile in terms of health and strength. This is virile in terms of being able to produce as many children in as short a period of time as possible. That's his name. And the third name, Shelah, kind of means pause, you know. This was a surprise, a third child that was a surprise. It means kind of pause. And the Bible tells us that God be praised decides that he's going to have to take care of his sons. So, verse 6. God be praised got a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now, Tamar is an interesting name as well. She is a Canaanite. She's a pagan, and her name means source of life. So we have source of life, who is married to ostensibly a God-fearing man in Ur, and we see the rest of the story. But Ur, God be praised, firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight. And so the Lord put him to death. Isn't that wonderful? Judgment's taken care of, we're dealt with. What is it that Ur did that caused God to actually decide that it was important for him to put him to death? Well, the Bible doesn't actually tell us, but the context does. And it's the rabbis who actually take out of this context and share with us the information that gives us a clue as to why Ur could not be allowed to continue to live. When Ur, who is a follower of God, a disciple of God, marries Tamar, the source of life, he is supposed to actually have the characteristics of God evident in the way in which he actually does his life. But he doesn't. And what the rabbis actually have written is that they believe that Ur was physically and emotionally and particularly spiritually abusive when it came to the role that he had with Tamar. And that the community around started to recognize that Tamar was not being treated like a woman should be treated and was being treated evilly by a man who claimed to be a follower of God. And as a result of that, the rabbis extrapolate and they suggest that God actually had to put him to death in order for the character of God, his name, to maintain its righteousness. And so Tamar is a victim of abuse. And as a result of the victim of abuse, God puts her husband to death without her being pregnant with a child. And you have to remember that back in those days, there was no centerlink. The only way in which you were able to survive if you were a woman was that you had to have a male heir who would be responsible for you when your husband, who was usually 20 to 30 years older than you, died. And so when he died, your son was to take care of you until the day of your death. If you did not have a son, then you were considered to be cursed, and as a result of the curse, you would not be seen with any kind of stature in your community, even as a wise older woman. But Tamar is not a wise older woman. She's a young woman. And in the course of her very short marriage to Ur, she experiences things that any woman should never experience. And as a result of what she's experiencing, she then sees that God takes his life and she is left destitute. Now, the Bible does take this into consideration. I want you to come with me to Deuteronomy chapter 25. And in Deuteronomy chapter 25, we see what God actually puts in place for women who do not have male heirs to take care of them. Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside of the family. Her husband's brother will take her and marry her, and he will fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and the first son that she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. Okay. So here is our centerlink. Now, I just want to ask a question. Women, how many of you are married? Please raise your hand so I can see. Yep, keep your hands up. How many of you, your husband has a brother? And if your husband died, how many of you would marry the brother? All the hands go down rapidly. I mean, rapidly, because you chose your husband, right? You didn't choose the brother, you chose the husband. But here, the situation finds that your husband dies, and when he dies, you have no child. You have to marry the other brother. How awkward is that? The other brother is also quite an awkward fellow. Come back with me to Genesis chapter 38, and we start in verse 8, because here is where Onan, the virile one, is involved in the relationship with the source of life. Now, she's not a source of life to date, right? She's actually been the source of death. One husband dead, no children. Verse 8. Then God be praised, said to the virile one, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as her brother-in-law to produce offspring for your brother. But the virile one knew that the offspring would not be his. And so whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his seed on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. And what he did was wicked in the Lord's sight. And so he put him to death too. So, I mean, this source of life woman has now been the source of death for two men. And this second man, who is the virile one, every time that he comes to see the source of life, chooses not to make life, but actually to get life out of the way, because he knew that according to Deuteronomy chapter 25, whoever was born from source of life would not carry his name. And further to that, that if there was an heir, that heir would carry the name of the firstborn and receive the inheritance of the firstborn, which was the majority share of the land that, God be praised, owned. And so the virile one knew that if he produced an heir, he was going to miss out. And if he did not produce an heir, then all of the land of his brother and his land would belong to him, and he would become a wealthy man having multiple different wives. Are you with me, church? So God saw that his character was being maligned again, and because his character was being maligned and the truth and justice of who he was being completely knocked over, God intervenes, and as a result of the intervention, this man dies. So now we have two sons of God be praised. He is not praising God at the moment, but two sons have died, and he decides to take the law into his own hands and change the destiny of Tamar, source of life. So he's responsible to actually put Sheila in to sort out this problem, right? So come with me to verse 11. God be praised, then said to his daughter-in-law, source of life, I want you to live as a widow in your father's house until my son, Sheila, grows up. For he thought, he may die too, just like his brothers. So source of life went to live in her father's house. Now this sounds so innocuous, doesn't it? Source of life, Tamar goes back to her father's house. Her father is going to take her in, treat her really, really well. But the truth is that the moment that Tamar's father made the contract with Judah, at that time Tamar becomes Judah's property and is responsible in Judah's home. So when Judah, God be praised, sends Tamar back to her father's home, he is sharing with the entire community that she did not perform, she has not produced an heir, two of the sons have died, and she is going back not as a daughter of her father, but actually as a vassal, as a servant of her father. She wasn't going to be living in her father's home, she was actually going to be living in the servants' quarters. She was going back in disgrace. She was going back with no honor. She was going back without a dowry. It had already been paid out. And she was not going to be treated with favor because now it was another mouth to feed for her father and her mother. And she lives there for quite some time. The Bible actually doesn't tell us how long she lives there, but there probably were several years that went by as Sheila was getting older. And she notices that Sheila is not getting, is not being given to her in marriage. Verse 12. After a long time, God be praised's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. And when God be praised had recovered from the grief, he went up to the town of Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira the Abdullamite went with him. Now, when Source of Life was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothing, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then she sat down at the entrance to Enaim. Enaim, by the way, that town's name means the eyes of judgment are upon you. So she sits down at the front gate of the eyes of judgment are upon you, and she takes off her widow's clothing and she places on herself the clothing that would suggest that she was a prostitute of one of the temples. For she saw that though Sheila had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. Now when God be praised saw her, he thought she was what? What does the Bible say? That she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. Okay, now, let me ask you a question. How did Tamar know what to wear that would cause Judah to stop? Unless it was Judah's annual stop. Are you with me, church? God be praised, on a yearly basis, would stop by the shrine of one of the temples and proceed to pay for a prostitute because God be praised wasn't actually a true believer in God. He was more a Canaanite than he was a true believer. He actually believed in the whole concept of the circle of life. And therefore, in order for his fields and his sheep to produce more, he needed to participate in a ritual that would potentially suggest that he could produce more. And Tamar, the Canaanite, knew that that's what he did. And so in the year when she made the decision to stand up for herself, she goes ahead and does something that we would look at as being quite, you know, not good. She had another thing available to her, but she chose not to do it. I'm going to share with you what that is here in a little bit, because it'll show you how generous Tamar really was when compared to the non-generous nature of who Judah was at the time. Let's read what she does. "And what will you give me to sleep with you?" she asked. It's a good question. "I'll send you a young goat from my flock. And what will you give me in pledge until you send this goat? Because I can't really trust that you're going to send me something. You haven't sent me your son." Remember, she's thinking that. He doesn't know that because he hasn't recognized her. Now, I've got to ask you a question, you know. How in the world does he not recognize her? Right? We had to go through COVID. And most of us had to wear masks. But if you knew the person well enough, were you able to recognize them by their eyes? Yes. And the fact is that in those little towns, which normally measured between 150 and 200 people, most everybody knew who everybody was. But the fascinating thing is that women were allowed to work as long as they were not married. When they became married, they were not allowed to work, and they were not allowed to actually be at the front gate unless they were part of the one job that was allowed to be at the front gate. But in order for the women to be allowed to be at the front gate, they had to keep the honor of the family by wearing something across their face to pretend that nobody would recognize them. Are you with me? So the hypocrisy of the town was to pretend that nobody knew who was actually soliciting at the front of the city gates. All of the elders sat at the front of the city gates because it was the responsibility of the elders to ensure that whoever was passing by who was a foreigner had their approval to come into town to do business. And that business included being with the women whose faces were covered, who everybody knew their name. But everybody pretended that they didn't in order for the honor of the family to be kept. So God be praised, looks at Source of Life, and he says, "What would you like? How about I share these things with you?" And here's what he says. "What pledge should I give you?" She says, "You give me your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand." And he gave it to her. He slept with her. And blow me down, she gets pregnant. She's been the source of death for two sons who have not been able to get her pregnant. And in this most interesting of transactions, she gets pregnant on one go. Quite incredible. From an old guy. And in the process, she requires two very important things. The seal and the cord that holds the seal in place. It usually was around the neck of a man. And the seal was the hardened clay that had his insignature on it, that every time that he made a contract with somebody else, he would take it off, he would press it into softer clay and indicate that he was in a binding contract with you. Today, that would be a credit card. So he gave her his credit card. Now, to use a credit card appropriately, you need to know certain things. But one of the most important things that you need to have is you need to have an ID that proves that you are the person that's supposed to hold the credit card. And so he gave her his walking stick or his shepherd's rod. Again, we normally think of this and we don't really think too much about it, but the shepherd's rod was an important ID. It had your name at the top, and then it had the name of your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, and all the special men in your family so that everybody knew that it was your walking stick. It was like your passport. So he gave her his passport and his credit card, and then the next day he sends his friend Hiram the Adullamite to actually pay for the transaction. Verse 20. "Meanwhile, God be praised, send the young goat by his friend the Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman. But he couldn't find her. He asked the men who lived there, 'Where is the shrine prostitute who is beside the road at the eyes of God are judging you?' 'There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here,' they said. So he went back to Judah, God be praised, and he said, 'I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said there hasn't been a shrine prostitute here.'" Are you sure that you met somebody? That's really what's being asked here. "And God be praised, said, 'Let her keep what she has, or we are all going to become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you didn't find her.'" 3 months go by. And in the process of that 3 months, rumors start to go around. Hey, we think that source of life is pregnant, and she's not married, and therefore we've got a problem. And those rumors start to go beyond the town where she lives into the communities around, and finally, word gets to God be praised. Now, God be praised is more than happy to pay for services rendered, but he never takes it on board that he may be just as much of a hypocrite, does he? And look at what he says. Bring her out and have her burned to death, the last part of verse 24. Bring her out and have her burned to death. As if he's a man vindicated by how good he is compared to how bad she is. I wish I could have been there in this transaction. It would be like Pastor Daniel sitting in the board meeting, and there's an accusation made against a woman in this church of bad behavior. And in the board meeting, she says, well, I'm pregnant, and the man who did it has this passport and this credit card. Look at what she says. I am pregnant by the man who owns these things. And she added, see if you can recognize them. I mean, she has a bit of, you know, chutzpah to her. See if you can recognize them. And notice what God be praised does. Judah recognized them and said, what did he say? She is more what? Now, hang on a minute. How is it possible that she is more righteous? She's the one who actually put on a disguise. Okay, it's a silly disguise, but it worked. He paid for the services, and now he actually says she is more righteous than him. So there must be something that she could have done that would have been less righteous than what she actually did do. So come with me again to Deuteronomy chapter 25, and let's see what was her right. Now remember, women didn't have a lot of rights, but this was a right that was cast in stone, written in stone. Here's what it says in verse 7. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, so Onan had the right not to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, my husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. Then the elders of his town will summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, I do not want to marry her, his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, this is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled ones. Doesn't that sound horrific? You're going to be known as the unsandaled ones. Well, I mean, who cares, right? You only care when you understand the cultural significance of what this woman had the right to do. And because, God be praised, Judah had not actually followed through with his responsibility, and Onan had not followed through with his responsibility, she could have gone to the elders and made her case, and her case was so strong that ultimately the family could have been called the family of the unsandaled ones. So what does it mean? I got to be very careful because we have children here. And so let me just be as open as I can without offending anybody. And here's what it meant. The woman had the right to actually stand up in front of the entire community of elders who ran the town. And if the contract, which she had purchased with her dowry, was not being fulfilled, that woman had the right to go up to the man who wasn't fulfilling it, and in the presence of all of the elders, take off his sandal and spit in his face. Now, just so that you understand what that means, the foot symbolizes the male reproductive. The sandal symbolizes the female reproductive. And the spit, well, you guys can figure that out for yourselves. So she had the right to stand up in the community and tell the entire community that this guy is not man enough to do what he claims. And from that moment, the family would be called the family of the unsandaled one. And what father would willingly pay a dowry to the family of the unsandaled one. At that moment, that family's lineage would come to an end, and there was never going to be anyone else with that name. Are you with me, church? So she held the key to the family's lineage in her hand, and she chose not to do that. She actually chose to do something more gracious than that, which is why God be praised said, she is more righteous than I. Now, the Bible goes on to tell us that she ends up with two sons, a double blessing, and a blessing that is quite one that made noise in the community, if you will. But what most of us forget when we're reading the story, even if we get to this material and understand it, is that the plan of salvation was actually at work in this very situation. You see, the plan of salvation did not go through Rachel and her boys. The plan of salvation goes through Leah. Leah's name, by the way, means haggard old leathery cow. Fascinating name. So sorry if any of you are named Leah. It's in the Akkadian. In the English, it means something much more, much, much prettier. But haggard old leathery cow, who was not liked by her husband, has a fourth son named God be praised, who does not do a lot of things to praise God or to bring God's character into good repute. He ends up sleeping with this prostitute who is a pagan woman named Source of Life, who does something more gracious than he or his sons or his family had done. And she ends up with two children. And we are told something even more important in the book of Matthew, chapter 1. In the book of Matthew, chapter 1, we read, this is a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Abraham, the source of life for all of humanity. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob was the father of God be praised and his 12 brothers. God be praised was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Source of Life. She's the first woman that's actually mentioned in Matthew chapter 1. She's a pagan woman whose name means Source of Life, who chose to not follow through with the legal action that she could have followed through on, and instead chose to do something far more gracious, even though no grace or mercy had been given to her by any of the three men who should have been showing her the character of God. And while she becomes the source of death for two of those men because of their actions, God actually blesses her with two sons who become part of the saving of the covenant in order for the seed of Jesus to be manifest in Matthew chapter 1. It's quite a story, isn't it? And one where you start to wonder, who are you the source of life for yourself? She becomes a source of life for the lineage of Jesus. And as such, he who is the source of life for all of us, she is a part of that. And the question each one of us needs to ask ourselves, who are we the source of life for in our family, in our community, in our city? Who will never come to Jesus unless they come into contact with you and learn from you who your source of life is? It's one of those questions we don't ask enough. It's a question that in Papua New Guinea they ask all the time. And of the 540 people that we baptized, just at my site, there were 1,000 more who asked for Bible studies. 1,000 more. Can you imagine having 1,000 Bible studies? It was the church leadership that stood up, not the pastors. The church leadership stood up and said, we'll do the Bible studies. And they're the ones who are going to make sure that there's 1,000 more people baptized in the month of October when the second opportunity for the source of life to be revealed is given. God tells us that we need to be planting seeds wherever we go. Because as we plant those seeds, we may potentially become the source of life for entire families that we never would have known anything about if it wasn't for the fact that God opened the way. God used a pagan woman to transform the life of God be praised. Now, in closing, Judah The man who chose to sell Joseph into slavery, whose name means God be praised, who had two sons who did not do anything well, who said hypocritically, "Burn her, for she has done things wrong," but realized that she was more righteous than him. From that moment on, Judah is a different man. For the rest of the book of Genesis, every time that you see the name of Judah, he is a man who is wanting to be a man of integrity, a man of character, a man to be held to account. So when the opportunity comes for Joseph to keep Benjamin, it's Judah that stands up and says, "We cannot do this. It would be a sin against our father." And he's the one who pleads on behalf of his brother Benjamin, "Take me instead." And it's because of the relationship that he had with his daughter-in-law, a pagan woman, who actually showed him the true character of Jesus, that he himself was transformed. It's a great story, and one that you can participate in as well, because you may be the source of life for someone that God wants you to meet.